在习近平主政之下的中共，对内更压制，对外更强势，同时结合了网络科技，进化为一个数位集权，不但在全球范围发挥影响力，也对国际秩序与自由民主阵营造成威胁。从好莱坞到常春藤大学，从西岸的硅谷到东岸的华尔街，中共究竟是如何缜密的布局和策划它的全球战略？美中之间的这场竞争究竟是谁占上风？美国之音今天特别为您邀请到刚刚出版《最后的斗争：中共全球战略大揭秘》的华盛顿智库2049计划研究所资深主任，同时也是《中共公台大解密》一书的作者易思安先生 （Mr. Ian Easton） 来跟大家分享他在这本新书的写作过程当中有哪些惊人的发现。易思安先生，非常欢迎您再次来到《美国之音
Stephanie，你好，美国之音的观众朋友们，大家好。
》。Okay, so first of all, I would like to you to share with us what inspired you to write this new book, and also why you picked the name "最后的斗争" (The Final Struggle). That we know that your last book, "中共公台大解密 ," you focus on China's invasion plan, Taiwan's defense, and American strategy in Asia. But in this new book, you focus on CCP's global strategy. So how are these two books different and how are they related? That's my first question.
Okay, great. Yeah, so in this book, the whole book was really driven by one question that I had. And it was a question that I started to think about 4 years ago. Because here in Washington, D.C., we've had this really rich debate about what our China policy should be and what our approach to strategic competition with China should be. And so I started to wonder what that discussion looked like in Beijing. I started to wonder if Xi Jinping and the Chinese Communist Party had a strategy for long-term strategic competition against us, and what their intentions were, what their plans were, and what that might look for the United States. And so that was really the fundamental question that drove the research for this book. The title comes from actually a song. It's the lyrics of the song, the Internationale, which was the national anthem of the Bolsheviks, the early Soviet Union. It was the national anthem of the Chinese Communist Party during the Chinese Civil War. And today, under Xi Jinping, that song is sung as the closing number at all major political events. And there's a couple of lines in there that really stood out to me. One is that we must be masters of the world. There's a line in the song that says that repeatedly. There's another line that says, "This is the final struggle. All communists must join together to achieve the Internationale," which of course is code for world socialism. And that kind of language really struck me as being very interesting, very strange. And then I started to read Xi Jinping's speeches and writings attributed to Xi Jinping. And that same kind of language about a struggle and this almost apocalyptic event that's coming, that they're trying to achieve utopia, that really struck me. And I think that gets really to the heart of what they're trying to achieve in their strategy.
So, my follow-up very quickly, can you please briefly tell us about what kind of internal documents of CCP you have been studying for this new book?
Yeah, so the book draws from a series of internal documents that the People's Liberation Army produced as teaching material at their National Defense University. It was published in 2018, and it's a series of documents, really training textbooks, actually, on Xi Jinping thought. So, what every military officer needs to know, or at least every high-ranking officer needs to know, about what Chairman Xi thinks about China's strategy, Chinese plans, and what they're doing to achieve those plans, everything from military civil fusion to One Belt, One Road. And it struck me as being a remarkably rich source of new knowledge.
Okay, so next question is that the Biden administration has repeatedly said that the United States is not seeking a new Cold War with China. But you point out in this book that Beijing's plan is much more sophisticated than any war in the history we have ever seen. So it is a silent invasion, according to your book. And in theory, this could actually work. So how exactly is Xi Jinping, his plan to challenge the United States for global domination?
Yeah, one of the things that's so remarkable about the way the Chinese Communist Party is engaging in their strategy for long-term strategic competition against us is that it's comprehensive in nature. So they're using all of the different instruments of statecraft. They're using all the tools in the toolkit. Here in Washington, we tend to think of competition as primarily a military or a defense issue. We don't generally think of trade and economics or research or technology, these being fields of international competition. We actually tend to think of them as areas for cooperation, but that's certainly not the case in Beijing. Those that walk the halls of power in Zhongnanhai have this view that their strategic objective is very difficult. It's going to be very difficult to achieve, and they're up against a very formidable adversary. And so they have to use all of the tools at their disposal. And when you look at what they're doing and what they've achieved so far, and then you try to project forward into the future, as I try to do in this book to explore some some scenarios, one of the things that I found very concerning, very disquieting, was the idea that we here in the United States could actually be losing. We could actually lose, that the People's Republic of China is far more powerful than the former Soviet Union. They're far more powerful than Nazi Germany, for example, or the Empire of Japan that we faced in the 1940s. We've never faced another superpower as capable as the PRC. And I think if we just take it for granted that we will win without much effort, I think that we're going to be in trouble.
We will talk about, you know, how United States can win back later. But because you just mentioned that you studied some of Xi Jinping's speeches when you write this book. So I want to ask, in this book, you mentioned about Xi Jinping's fanatical cult of personality and Xi Jinping's 思想, Xi Jinping thought. And that is the most important political mission of the entire party. So how does Chinese Communist Party use Xi Jinping's 思想 and as well as the technology of internet to create a digital dictatorship, in your opinion?
Yeah, so one of the things that really stands out, or at least it did for me doing the research, is reading books about Xi Jinping thought, many of which are actually available on Amazon. Anybody can go on Amazon and type in Mandarin Xi Jinping thought, and you can get textbooks delivered to your house from the Central Party School in Beijing or the Central Propaganda Department. And you can, of course, go on People's Daily or Xinhua and read Xi Jinping's speeches, or go on Qiushi and read his speeches. And when you do, it is remarkable how fanatical, actually, they come across, how they talk about Xi Jinping as it's like he's a god. And it's just incredible the way he is described by other Chinese officials and in teaching materials. It's incredible to me now that all students in China, from elementary school on up to graduate school, have to study Xi Jinping thought, Xi Jinping's own personal ideology. It's remarkable that that has been enshrined into the party constitution, into the PRC constitution. So it's a really, I think, worrisome trend that we're seeing in China, especially once you actually look into what those documents say. And that's something that I try to do in the book, is to quote those documents at some length so that readers have an idea of what is Xi Jinping thought.
And yeah, you use a lot of graphics in your book. By some of the graphic, I can feel that this kind of CCP used this technology of internet device. And with this digital totalitarian, it's not only to control the Chinese people within China, but also try to transform the lives and the thoughts of the people around the world. Can you elaborate about this part?
Absolutely, yeah. So this is a global campaign. This is not just about controlling the people of China. It's not just about repressing their freedom of expression or their freedom of information. This is about exporting Chinese-style authoritarianism around the world. And they're doing this in a number of different ways. One is to co-opt and hold hostage American corporations, including media corporations, doing that to our universities, doing that to Hollywood, to make sure that we self-censor here in the United States, to make sure that we don't write books like the one that I wrote here, and to make sure that if you do, that nobody ever sees it, nobody ever reads it. And so that's a very significant challenge to our freedom of speech and our freedom of expression. What they're also doing to enforce that, though, is to gain leverage over Silicon Valley and to use those tools, the telecommunications tools, which we all enjoy and benefit greatly from in our everyday lives, but to actually turn those into tools of censorship. Mm-hmm. And so we've seen these very large, really super corporations come out of China, such as Baidu, Tencent, Alibaba, Xiaomi, Lenovo, and of course the list goes on and on. And they've absolutely flooded our marketplace. So if you go into a Best Buy today, for example, to buy a computer or a drone or a smart TV or smart appliances, they're all made in China and they're all made by arms of the Chinese state. And in fact, many of those companies have very close relationship with China's military intelligence services. And so they're actually laying the infrastructure and they're using their ability to manipulate the market and using predatory economics to actually achieve that goal.
CP has so many ways to do their silent invasion, if I can call so. So you mentioned about this in this book that CCP is turning Wall Street red. So how exactly did the CCP infiltrate the United States from Hollywood to Ivy League, from the Silicon Valley to Wall Street? Yeah.
Well, again, it was a comprehensive effort, and it began with a myth, and it was the myth of 1 billion or now 1.4 billion Chinese customers. It was the idea that every company, every organization in the world really had no choice but go to China and to cooperate with China's government in order to get access to China's growing market. Mm-hmm. And it was also the idea that China would become everybody's bank. So if you have a film project in Hollywood and you need extra investment money to see the film to the finish line, or if you're a university and the federal government here in the United States has cut your funding, for example, but you want to do well, you want to grow, so you need to recruit more Chinese students who will pay full tuition. Or if you're a professor and you want to supplement your income, then that it somehow is okay to consult for the Chinese government to invite Chinese entities into your labs and do basic research for them, as many do for companies like Baidu and Huawei and ZTE here in the United States and in Canada and really around the world. And so it's a comprehensive effort. In the case of Wall Street, what they did is they started to list Chinese state-owned enterprises and Chinese state-controlled companies on NASDAQ, on the New York Stock Exchange, and to get American investors to actually pour their own capital into the success of those companies, to tie them to those companies. And in more recent years, American investors have actually started to pour money, not just into Chinese companies listed in New York, but actually into Chinese government-controlled securities in Beijing and in Shanghai.
And also in this book, Ian, you describe the totalitarian CCP is the biggest threat, not only to the United States, but also to the world, by establishing so-called New World Order. Could you please explain how exactly does the CCP infiltrate those international organizations?
Yeah, so I think this is one of the great tragedies, actually, of our time, is the way wonderful organizations, very pro-democracy, pro-human freedom, pro-human rights, kind of organizations like the United Nations and United Nations affiliates have actually been infiltrated. And now in many cases, they have affiliate organizations that are being run by Chinese government officials. We've seen this happen at the World Health Organization, where Dr. Tedros is, his predecessor was a Chinese government official, Dr. Margaret Chan. And I write about that in the book. And I write about her relationship with Chinese intelligence. We've seen that with the International Telecommunications Union, which is now run by a Chinese government official. We've seen that with ICAO, the International Civil Aviation Organization. Of course, we saw that with Interpol. And so now we're in a situation where, because Chinese officials and Chinese Communist Party members have been able to establish themselves in leadership positions, they're able to change the fundamental character of those organizations. So those organizations, which used to be pro-democracy, pro-freedom, pro-human rights, now are actually pro-authoritarianism, and they're actually helping China's government achieve its political objectives.
And Ian, I have to tell you that when I read this book, sometimes I feel like I'm reading a thriller. Just like what you said in the beginning of this book, this is a scary story and far darker than I expected. For example, on one of your chapters, you mentioned this smart Goliath crane used to make England's newest aircraft carrier are actually the same used in China's military bases in South China Sea. And when I kept reading down through the paragraphs, and then I realized it could also have impacts on Taiwan. So the CCP even control at least the 14 ports in the United States. We will show the graphic, you know, when you answer the questions. So could you please share with our audience what you find here? Because I really think that more people in the world should know about this, Ian.
Yeah, so the research began with that question of what is China's strategy? And then, of course, the next obvious question is, so how are they trying to put that into practice? How are they actually implementing this strategy? And so I tried to find real-world examples. And one of the things that I came across that really surprised me was how the Royal Navy in the United Kingdom actually was purchasing smart cranes from a Chinese state-owned enterprise, actually from China's military industrial complex, and using that to make its capital ships, its two newest aircraft carriers, the HMS Prince of Wales and HMS Queen Elizabeth. So I started to dig into that company. It turns out that that company, its parent organization, because it's a wholly owned subsidiary, has actually been blacklisted by the Pentagon for constructing artificial military facilities in the South China Sea, which have been militarized and used to harass American ships and aircraft and allies, as well as they're conducting freedom of passage operations. It turns out that same company actually has smart cranes that dominate every single major American container port. So the gantry cranes that we rely on for ship-to-shore, that critical infrastructure that's there that supplies our entire economy that we all rely on, and especially now we've during the pandemic, we've all come to realize how important and how vulnerable our supply chains are. It turns out that the cranes that are actually doing the work are part of China's military industrial complex. And they're at all 14, in fact, more than that, at all of our major container ports and at container ports around the world. And so that's one of many examples that I give in the book of how China's putting its strategy into practice. And I think it's one of the reasons policymakers in democracies the world over feel overwhelmed. They feel increasingly helpless to push back because China's government has achieved such a remarkable degree of leverage over their economies.
Ian, you when you introduced these smart cranes that used in Chinese military bases and also to build the England two newest aircraft carrier, you also mentioned about Taiwan. So that lead me to the next two questions. It's also about Taiwan, because your last book, the Zhonggong Gong Tai Da Jie Mi, also focused on China's invasion plan and Taiwan's defense. So I want to ask you that, did the internal CCP document that you read for this new book also show that Xi Jinping is determined to attack Taiwan no matter what? And is it also part of so-called CCP's global strategy?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's no question that Xi Jinping, and not just him, as an individual, but the Chinese Communist Party as an organization, is bound and determined to annex, to conquer, to take over Taiwan. Now, there's a really interesting and I think very important debate going on in Washington and in Taipei and in other capitals around the world regarding whether there's a timeline, whether the clock is ticking and an attack is inevitable. I don't know one way or another if it's inevitable or if Xi Jinping and the CCP intend to use other means to achieve that same end state. But it is clear that taking Taiwan is part of China's global strategy, and it's a step towards a much broader global domination.
Okay, so how did the war, when we see the war in Ukraine, many people discuss like how did the war in Ukraine change Xi Jinping's strategy of attacking Taiwan? Would it be faster or more brutal? Because some people predict that Xi Jinping may hesitate to attack Taiwan because of the war in Ukraine, but some people think it could be faster, like a lightning war, flash war, and more brutal and more bloody. So can the United States really help defend Taiwan, just like what we heard the President Biden said many times that he will?
Well, at the end of the day, it's a matter of will. Does the President of the United States have the will to order the U.S. military to help defend Taiwan? That really is the ultimate question. If the president gives the order, the U.S. military does have very detailed plans, apparently in place, that they exercise on a regular basis. So they are ready to execute if the president gives those orders. The problem is nobody is sure if the president will give those orders. President Biden clearly intends to defend Taiwan militarily if they're invaded. He's said that repeatedly. But nobody knows what the details are. Nobody knows when that might start, because an invasion operation could come very quickly, and it could come in ways that surprise us. You know, American strategists, American policymakers, American generals and admirals are often surprised by the behavior of China's government and China's military. And so it is perfectly possible that strategic surprise could occur. Once it does, then it's a question of time. How fast can the United States act? And of course, nobody knows the answers to these questions. We have no data, happily. Fortunately, we have no data. We have nothing we can look at because nothing like this has ever happened before. So it really is the most dangerous scenario in the world today.
Let's talk about how Washington can respond to the CCP's global strategy, because you said Xi Jinping's monopolization of political power has triggered a historic tectonic shift in U.S. foreign policy. But is this tectonic shift in the right direction? The Biden administration has issued its national security strategy, and then we have heard Secretary Blinken also has outlined this invest, align, and compete strategy to face China's challenge. In your opinion, is Biden administration doing enough to respond to CCP's global strategy?
You know, I'll just be very candid. I'm very confused, actually, by my government's China policy and its strategy for long-term strategic competition. I think it is true that there has been a tectonic shift and that we're not going to go back to pre-2017 assumptions about cooperating with China, because really that's the shift. That's what happened is after the 19th Party Congress, is the U.S. government came to a realization that we had to have strategic competition with China. Otherwise, our own national interests would suffer as a result, and there actually could be war. If we don't prepare to deter war and to prevent war with China, that could actually occur. And so now this is become the focus, the number one priority for the U.S. government. But I'm still quite confused, and I think it's still early days for the Biden administration. On the one hand, we've heard Secretary of State Blinken talk about how China's regime is genocidal, how they are committing genocide in Xinjiang. We've heard about how this is a regime that is using predatory economics to undermine our own economy, to undermine our success as a country. This is a regime that, according to the U.S. State Department and the White House, actually does intend to undermine the entire liberal world order that the United States worked to achieve in the wake of World War II. So I think the description of the threat is accurate, and it's very clear. What is confusing, what is less clear, is when the administration says that they do not seek a new Cold War with China, that they hope to continue trade with China, and that they are looking for areas for cooperation with China's government. To me, that seems confused. It seems self-defeating. It seems self-contradictory. I can't think of another case in American foreign policy history where the U.S. government said a certain country is committing genocide and we want to actually trade more with that country. We want to trade with them. We want to do business with them. To me, that seems very strange.
So, Ian, do you have, because you said that it's self-contradictory, do you have any policy recommendation for the Biden administration? And also, I think it's very important to know, after writing this book, after you write this book, did you find any weakness inside CCP's global strategy? Can we find, do you know like where exactly is Xi Jinping's Achilles heel that for the United States to win this battle?
I think when you look at what they're doing and when you look at what has made them successful, it's quite clear that their greatest strength is their ability to get Americans to cooperate with them, to get Americans to invest their own capital, their own time, their own talent, their own managerial know-how into China's success and actually to buy Chinese products that can be used to censor and to control what people read and to collect their data, their personal and private data. And so it seems obvious, I think, doesn't it, that we need to start buying from other countries, that we need to start doing business with other countries, that we need to stop trading with Chinese military companies or companies that are known to be arms of the Chinese military or fronts for the Chinese military or for Chinese intelligence, or companies that are engaged in gross violations of human rights. It's very important that we start to decouple, especially from these entities that mean to do us harm. And that seems, I really do think that it's just common sense that you don't want, for example, your critical infrastructure to rely on your adversary, your rival. So we don't want, I should think we would not want Chinese state-owned enterprises in our ports, for example. We would not want Chinese electronics in our government offices or in our prison system, for example. I have a chapter where I talk about how prisons in the United States use Chinese communication devices, or police departments, fire departments, banks, schools, universities, oil rigs, metro systems, the New York subway, that we need to get them out. And I think if we do that, that will turn into an Achilles heel for China, because if you look at the way their economy works, it's very predatory. And like any predator, if they have no prey, then they'll starve. Their strategy will not work unless they have prey. And so we want to make sure that we're not their prey.
And Ian, Xi Jinping seems like very confident, you know, winning this war. And many people inside China say that East is winning and the West is losing. So finally, and probably also the most difficult question, but it's the question on everybody's mind, like who will get ultimate victory of this final struggle? China, your U.S., your final thoughts.
Well, nobody can say. Nobody can peer into the future and tell us what scenes might occur, because those scenes have not yet occurred. Nobody can predict the future. What we can say is that if we prepare accordingly, then we'll have a better future. But if we continue to make the same mistakes that we've made as a country, and if Washington does not reform its China policy, then we're going to have a lot of trouble in the future. And so I think it's very important for us as a nation to wake up to the reality that we face. And it's a very unpleasant reality, but we need to recognize it, we need to acknowledge it, and then we need to act accordingly.
OK, 我们非常感谢易思安先生再次接受美国之音的专访，感谢您。
谢谢 Daphne。
好的，我们要感谢听众和观众朋友们的收听和收看，提醒您，来宾发表的是个人观点，不代表美国之音。